Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Case number 085203, United States of America, the Williams Companies, Inc., et al. Appellants versus Scott Thompson. Mr. Tulumello for the appellants, Ms. Rao for the Appellee USA, Mr. Nglima for the Appellee Thompson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Drew Tulumello, and I represent the Williams Companies. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I ask a question at the outset? After reading carefully all the briefs, my impression is that your only real concern in this case is that the information not go to your adversaries in California. That you really don't, if you get a protective order, you're perfectly happy. So is that correct?
That is incorrect, Your Honor. Our concern is enforcing the agreement we had with the Justice Department. And in 1984,
why would you care? In your final brief, you say, "Look, if you put it down with a protective order, we're largely protected." That seemed to me to be perfectly correct. Why wouldn't a protective order give you everything you need? You don't care about Thompson getting the information. You're concerned about the California plaintiffs.
Thompson is not our adversary. That is correct, Your Honor. But what is at stake here is the forced disclosure of materials that we deem to be privileged and confidential.
Why do you care about that?
Because that is a material condition of the agreement that we entered into with the Justice Department. I understand, Your Honors.
Counsel, well, please give me a direct answer. Why do you care about that? I understand your legal position, but I'm trying to figure out why there's anything at stake.
What's at stake is if the disclosure of the documents go to Thompson,
right.
that is yet a further distribution of the privileged and work product materials.
Counsel, I still reiterate my question. You're not, have I read your brief carefully and read all the briefs, you're not worried about Thompson being able to use the information in his defense. You're worried about the California plaintiffs.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that we don't care that Thompson.
Why? Why do you care about Thompson?
Your Honor, these are our privileged and work product materials. We don't want anyone to see them. That is why we entered into an agreement with the Justice Department to simply say, well, in one small case, we can identify a third party where disclosure may not prejudice you. So why should you care? Give up your rights under the confidentiality agreement. There's no prejudice to you. That's not how a privilege analysis works. If there is a privilege, the privilege holds. We don't need to justify to the court why the privilege should be breached or in a particular circumstance, whether there's some balancing of the equities that would favor disclosure to Mr. Thompson. If it is privileged, and we say it is, and if there is an agreement that forbids disclosure, which we and the Justice Department have said there is, that is the end of the analysis.
But
it is always possible.
I think Judge Silverman is trying to find out. I understand that you're staunchly in favor of the principle that you have been advocating. But I think Judge Silverman is trying to find out whether there's a practical consequence of what you, in your strong position, would regard as a breach of the principle.
Your Honor, it is impossible for us to foresee if there would be a practical harm to Williams. Just like any attorney-client communication made today by any client to any lawyer or any work product being generated in any law office today, there is always circumstances where you can envision a disclosure to third parties that wouldn't hurt the lawyer or the client at all. There are many circumstances where that's the case. So what I would like the court to focus on is the rule that is going to be set. It's always easy after the fact, after there's an agreement in place, to say, you know what, there really isn't much harm to disclosure in this particular circumstance. But what this case asks you to decide is what rule ex ante is going to apply. And here, the rule ex ante, as you have said in 1984 in In Re Subpoena Ducis Tecum, you said that a party that is dealing with the government has a, in order to preserve confidentiality, has a clear option available to it. And that is, it can, quote, insist on a promise of confidentiality before disclosure.
Let me ask you about that. Looking at one of the letters, JA-47, that's the letter of April 25th, 2003. In the next to last line, where you state that these blank documents will be afforded Rule 6E protection, and to the extent possible, you will assist Williams in preserving the confidentiality of these. To the extent possible, that's sort of a weasel phrase, if I can put it that way, such that, although I understand your point that the government took a different position in the district court, it is now arguing to us that it could not waive its obligations under the rules, Rule 16, much less under Brady, so that therefore, even if you had this agreement, it wouldn't bar the disclosure that the Mr. Thompson is seeking. What's your response there?
I'll take it in a couple different parts, Your Honor. First, I think there's no dispute that there is an agreement that these documents would be preserved and protected in the investigation. The Justice Department's position below, expressed repeatedly before the district court, was that the Thompson action did not, that the Thompson action fell outside the scope of the confidentiality agreement. And
well, but the investigation led, you're not disputing, are you, that the investigation, among other things, led to the indictment of Mr. Thompson?
I'm not disputing that, Your Honor, but what I am disputing, and what we in the Justice Department agreed on precisely in the district court, was that the agreement to limit it to the investigation did not permit disclosure in Mr. Thompson's criminal action. And I would direct the court to JA-106, and this is the Justice Department's filing in the district court, and they say Williams produced the materials with an explicit agreement and expectation that the materials would be kept confidential and that their production resulted in no waiver of the work product privilege with respect to any other action, that action being the United States proceedings in the district court in this case. Now, I agree with you that the government has taken the position that it must, if it enters into a non-waiver agreement, it must do so subject to its background obligations under positive law to produce documents in criminal proceedings. And we agree with that up to a point. Here, the government expressly represented that this material was not Brady, was not Giglio.
But the district court's ruling has to be presumed on the basis it was Brady.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. Under the standard of review that applies here, In Re Sealed Case in 2003, where the district court did not review the documents in camera, despite repeated invitations, both from Williams and from counsel for Mr. Thompson, and where there's no explication of the reasoning for the district court's order or any findings, no deference whatsoever is owed.
Let me go back to the question I started with. I'm now persuaded that you get no relief from the protective order, so I should ignore that entirely in this case. And if I conclude that your disclosure is involuntary, it was voluntary, then that's the end of the case and I don't have to worry about a protective order at all. Because you've given that away.
No, Your Honor, I quibble slightly. I think step one in the analysis is the non-waiver agreement enforceable? If it is enforceable, we win, the district court should be reversed. Now, if you find for some reason that the non-waiver agreement is unenforceable, then we fall back to our argument that under these particular circumstances, our conduct did not manifest an implied waiver as to third parties. So step one, is the agreement enforceable? Step two, did our conduct manifest an implied waiver? And I think we win on both of those. The agreement I'd like to focus on first, because that is where I think we have the most common ground with the Department of Justice.
Not anymore.
not anymore, Your Honor, but I think we have the better view, both of the agreement. We basically agree that the agreement is taken subject to the government's obligations to produce materials in criminal proceedings. This is not Brady material. There is no finding it's Brady material, no finding it's Giglio material. The government represented that it reviewed those files and that there was no such material in the district court. And so what you see in the Justice Department brief is that, well, we've got to review this decision below as impliedly concluding that this was Rule 16 material. And, of course, the district court did not make any type of discriminating analysis under Rule 16, which requires the government to produce not all of its files, but only information that is material to the defense. So we know the district court did not make the discriminating materiality analysis required by Rule 16. But even if this were Rule 16 material, it is our position, supported by our judgment, the Nobles case in the Supreme Court, that Rule 16 obligations are subject to and qualified by the work product doctrine. Nobles says quite clearly that common law work product protections apply in criminal proceedings. And the rule itself, 16A2 and 16B2, are expressly protective of work product.
Yeah,
in the hands of the government.
The court went quite as far as to decide the question in this case in Nobles.
That's true, Your Honor. And we are relying on Nobles only for, I think, a proposition that everybody in this case agrees with, which is that common law work product protections apply.
So under your first analysis, you're falling, as it were, within the Third Circuit case in RMI, where the district court had not made any finding as to materiality and had not examined the documents, and the Third Circuit just, not just, but sent it back to the district court to do so. And then your second argument would be, even if he had, you would like to come under the dictum of the Third Circuit in terms of your standing to raise those questions.
That's correct.
But I just want to be clear. I thought in this case we didn't have to get to that, in the sense that it's not as though the district court had looked at the documents and made a determination that these are material.
And I think Your Honor can reverse on that basis, because it's clear the district court did not make a Rule 16 materiality determination. That's sufficient in and of itself to justify reversal in this case. So that's point one, and I think that's undisputed on this record. He did not do that.
Reversal or remand?
Your Honor, I think we would accept a reversal with a remand for him to have the opportunity.
We accept a reversal or remand.
Your graciousness
overwhelms me.
Fair point, Your Honor. Fair point. So I think step one is, because he did not do that, reversal would be required and appreciated. Step two is even if we read the district court order as somehow impliedly saying that all of the materials we gave were Rule 16 materials, we think the work product protection still applies. All the agreement that we entered into with the Justice Department does is put our work product materials on the very same footing that the government's work product materials have under 16A2 and Mr. Thompson's work product materials have under 16B2. And so for either of those two reasons, reversal is required.
And now your argument, I guess I gather, is we could, if we bought your argument here, we wouldn't even have to raise a question of the voluntariness?
Correct, Your Honor. That's exactly right. These are antecedent to the voluntariness issue, and I think it is the simplest route to the correct result, and the one in which we share the most common ground with the Department of Justice, and the one that is the most consistent with your guidance in In Re Subpoena Ducas Tecum. That's correct.
All right. Do you want to save the rest of your time?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel for the United States.
May it please the court, my name is Sangeeta Rao. I'm with the Criminal Appellate Section of the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States. Turning first to the coercion issue, Williams
don't,
was...
Don't turn to that. What about his major thrust of his argument?
On selective waiver, as a matter of law and public policy, the government cannot agree to any kind of waiver that would trump its Rule 16 and Brady obligations.
Well, no. He's making a more limited argument. You heard it. He's saying the district judge never made a finding that this was 16 material or Brady material.
The district court did make an implicit finding in its order. In its order, it said, upon consideration of the motion to compel, the government's response, Williams' application for relief, and the entire record.
Oh, but there's no description, elaboration on that point.
That's true.
You, in fact, argued before the district judge it wasn't Brady, it wasn't 16,
and
it wasn't material. And so I assume you still have the same view of it.
We argue that in the district court, Your Honor, but
substantively, you still have the same view of that. I know you recognize in your brief that he must have implicitly held this, but you still have the same view, don't you?
We have the view if it weren't subject to a court order, but we don't believe it's open for contest anymore. The rule, the district court made a finding. We believe that
it's not open for contest.
It's a ruling by the district court. Only the government or Defendant Thompson could bring that issue before this court, and we haven't brought this issue before this court. It was a Rule 16 or Brady finding because Defendant Thompson made
its... In other words, your arguing has no standing to make that argument.
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things. One, your brief says more strongly it's not simply a matter of policy, but you say the government has no authority to waive its obligations under Rule 16 and Brady. And so, I mean, that's a slightly different take than just as a matter of Justice Department policy.
As a matter of law and policy, both. We agree that it is.
Which is it, policy or you have no authority?
Both. We don't believe we have any legal authority to waive our Rule 16 or Brady obligations in a side agreement with a third party. Any such agreement would be unenforceable.
All right. Now, the Third Circuit, you say that that's the only case you found on this issue about standing of a third party to challenge materiality. And you say it's just dictum in the Third Circuit case because the holding was, since the district court didn't make a finding of materiality and a third party was asking for a protective order, they would remand. But the Third Circuit gave a lot of reasons as to why a third party should be able to raise these issues. And I'm just wondering whether we need to reach that since here, I mean, the district court just grants the motion, period.
The district court didn't just, what the district court did here is different. In RMI, the government simply sought to turn over the materials to the defendant without a finding of materiality at all, even from the government. Here, we do think there's a difference because the district court granted the motion to compel, which was based on materiality and Brady.
That's not what his order says.
He just says
he's granting the motion to compel.
Right, which was based on Rule 16 and Brady. So
he doesn't cite any of that? He doesn't qualify it?
That's right. And we certainly wish that the district court had been more explicit in its ruling. But nevertheless, we think that the legitimate reading.
He didn't say for the reasons argued by the parties.
That's right. But he did say upon consideration of those grounds, and those were the only grounds offered, Rule 16, Brady, and perhaps Jenks was discussed in the various hearings. So
it may make a difference which it is, right? In other words, it may be that that Williams' argument is trumped by the Constitution, but not by Rule 16. Perfectly sensible to read into Rule 16 where the government happens to be in possession of other people's information that privileges for those other people attached to the documents.
The way Rule 16 makes the most sense, Your Honor, is to leave the materiality determination between the government, the court, and the defendant. But there is other protection in Rule 16 for interests like Williams, and that's in Rule 16D. Williams can seek a protective order to protect any work product interest it might have, but it would be under Rule 16D, not in contesting the materiality finding. We submit that the materiality finding is not before this court because neither the defendant or the government brought it before this court. But the Rule 16D protective order is there to take into account third-party interests. There could be a case where the government isn't sufficiently protecting a victim's interest or a confidential informant's interest. And if that were the case here, work product for a third party could possibly be considered under Rule 16D. And in this case, Williams has been able to point to no harm from disclosure in this case to defendant Thompson. They're worried about the California litigation. Those questions and the questions of whether selective waiver as a theoretical doctrine exists and whether the scope of the confidentiality agreement really should be decided in a separate case. This case could very easily be decided just based on the materiality determination is not before this court, and Rule 16D provides all the protection to Williams that it deserves. Now, we've also argued that disclosure should be allowed because Williams' agreement with the government, well, Williams hasn't met its burden of proving that.
To be clear what the government thinks is before this court, you say materiality isn't, but you said there was an implied determination by the district court, an implied finding by the district court that the materials the defendant was seeking were material.
That's right.
All right. So now the Williams Corporation is up here contesting the district court's ruling. And if there's an implied finding of materiality, as you argue, then why isn't that before the court?
They can't contest the materiality. Because Rule 16 is all about the disclosure obligations.
You're saying they don't have standing.
Yes.
So if we were to agree with you, there would be a conflict with the Third Circuit?
No, because we really think that the Third Circuit, the RMI decision, should be read as a finding that a third party has standing to move for a protective order. That's really all that was at issue. And we agree that a protective order would be appropriate in this case. We argue that in the district court, and we argued it here.
What are the reasons the Third Circuit gave? Do you want to address any of those?
The Third Circuit, after acknowledging that it had found no case in support of its view.
But it cited both a Supreme Court decision, Douglas, and a Seventh Circuit opinion that was dealing in a civil context, but it explained why the interests at stake were nonetheless the same. So, I mean, don't you have to get around at least those two cases?
The reason
to argue that there's no standing here? Those three cases, the Third Circuit, the Douglas, and the Seventh Circuit.
None of them were directly on point in a criminal case where there's been a Rule 16 materiality determination. None of them found that that a defendant could contest materiality. That wasn't the holding of any of those cases.
Counsel, I'd like to hear your argument why Williams doesn't have standing to challenge the materiality, the implicit finding on materiality. Why is it he doesn't have standing, or it does not have standing?
It doesn't have standing because a Rule 16 materiality determination, Rule 16 is all about disclosures between the defendant and the government. Only the defendant and the government and the court know the evidence in the case, the theories that the case is going to be tried on. They're the only ones that can really make.
But that is a factual matter that plainly isn't true. And in terms of normal standing doctrine, it's obvious that Williams has a very substantial interest.
And that has an injury in fact. There's no question. Yeah. There's no question. Williams has constitutional injury. Isn't that correct?
They have an interest.
No.
They have
constitutional injury. Injury in fact. There is no question about that, is there? Otherwise, they wouldn't be entitled to argue for a protective order. They obviously have injury in fact. So I'm trying to figure out why they don't have standing.
They don't have standing to contest the materiality determination. They don't have
Counsel,
standing.
I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to figure out why. Why, as a matter of standing doctrine, would they not have standing to challenge the materiality?
They have to have standing under the terms of the statute and under the terms of the rule. The rule has to give them some basis for claiming rights or claiming interests.
Well, that sounds like the old notion of standing where you have to have a legal right. That isn't the present law on standing. I'm trying to figure it out. Are you arguing they don't have prudential standing? Why?
We believe that they don't have standing because Rule 16.
It's not constitutional standing, is it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
What?
I don't believe. Yes, I think it's not. There is some injury involved.
There is constitutional standing. Okay, so why is there not standing?
To make a claim under Rule 16, the materiality determination, they need to have.
So that's your argument then would be prudential standing, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or do you have any authority for that proposition?
There's no authority on either side. There's no authority to say that the defendant can make a contest materiality.
But the courts that address this, both the Seventh Circuit, the Third Circuit in a criminal context, and the Supreme Court, were talking about the third party may be the only one who has any interest here in protecting. The government wants to prosecute Mr. Thompson. They want to comply with their obligations. So they're not interested in protecting these documents. And that was part of the analysis, that in terms of the adversary system, the party whose interests are at stake ought to be allowed to be heard by the court.
Well, we
may not win, but at least to be eligible to raise the argument.
We're saying under the rule-based scheme, there's no reason to give people like William standing under the materiality determination, Rule 16. They have
argument.
But
say there's no reason. That, at least two courts have thought there was a reason.
But there is reason under 16D. The rule contemplates taking into account third-party interests, but it contemplates doing that in a very specific way, and that's under Rule 16D. Those interests, all of everybody's interests in here, can be easily accommodated under Rule 16D. There can simply be a protective order issued so that their rights are not impinged in any other litigation, but then the government and the defendant's rights, because the government has an interest in a fair trial and not getting overturned on appeal.
Suppose the district judge had said, I don't care whether this is Rule 16, still less Brady. I think, as my own notions of fairness, it should be disclosed.
We couldn't
examine that.
We would still say it's up to the
as
government.
As long as the government didn't appeal, that is not before us.
That's true, but in fashioning a Rule 16 protective order, those facts would be before the court.
What facts?
The fact that the district court made a frivolous finding on the need for disclosure.
We would say, because the district court made a frivolous finding, we would order him to issue a protective order?
You would make the analysis under Rule 16. There does have to be some balancing.
Why
under
would
Rule
they
16D.
Not have? I'm still trying to understand the standing question. Is it necessary that their legal argument for standing be based on Rule 16?
I'm not sure I follow Your Honor's question.
Your argument that they don't have standing is based, as best I can tell, on a prudential standing theory, analogizing Rule 16 to a statute, saying they are not a party to be protected under the statute, or if they're protected, they're protected only under 16D. So we have to, so therefore we say an analogous to administrative law, we would say that they don't have prudential standing under the statute. That's your theory.
Yeah.
But is it clear that they would have to rely on Rule 16 for their argument that they have standing? I'll have to ask them.
Douglas opinion, the Supreme Court, that was an antitrust case, you may recall. And the Supreme Court was talking about the corporation's role in the interest in enforcement of Rule 6E, grand jury secrecy, and said that, you know, the corporation had a vital stake in maintaining grand jury secrecy and said they had standing. So, I mean, at least there, the court didn't seem to hook the standing to any provision in the rule, but rather
exactly.
The interests that were at stake were such that the third party would have standing. And I just don't see where your brief addresses that. That's if we agree with you that there's some sort of implied finding of materiality.
Your Honor, I would just say that the Douglas case is not a criminal case, and in a criminal case, there are weighty concerns.
But we're looking for some analysis, all right? And there's an analysis here, and you may disagree with it, and that's fine, but we need to know the basis for the disagreement. Otherwise, it's the Supreme Court suggesting why a third party would have a vital stake in protecting grand jury secrecy.
Protecting it in the Rule 60 context when materiality determinations between the defendant and the government were not at stake.
Yeah, but you said just a minute ago that Rule 16 may call for balancing in some context, right?
Yes.
So, and you acknowledge that under Rule 16, Williams has an interest. You've limited it to the protective order, but at any rate, an interest. In arguing a balance, how can it be that a party can argue only one side of the balance? In other words, it would seem to, if you're talking about balancing, you have to look at both sides, right? You can't just assume that the side against a party is infinitely powerful.
What we're saying in this case, Your Honor, is that here it just happens to be easy. There is materiality on the government side and no harm from the disclosure in this case.
Well, now, Williams has been able to. This is a merits argument, not a standing argument at all, right? Now you're saying that that the balance tilts in favor of disclosure overwhelmingly, okay? That's the current argument, but the standing is now out.
We're agreeing that in a particular case, under Rule 16D but not C, there might be some considerations of materiality that a third party would be able to bring in because there is some balancing that's involved. But the decision has to be made under 16D, and the fact that it's material cannot be contested. Once it's material, and that finding is not open to contest before this court, we're saying that's on this side of the scale. What's on the other side of the scale under Rule 16D?
Is materiality an undifferentiated blob of equivalent weight across all contexts?
No, we're not saying that, but it is.
It seems to me you are saying that because you're saying it can't be contested.
We're saying it is.
If it can't be contested in at all, then it can't be contested in degree, right, to show that the balance tilts the other way.
That's right, and in another case, that might be a problem for this court, but when Williams has pointed to nothing on this side from a perspective
order. So standing is out, both constitutional and prudential. You're just saying that on the merits, the interests of Thompson and the government overwhelm those of Williams.
In terms of 16D, that's correct.
Your argument on the coercion question is that the only reading of the agreement between you and Williams has to take into account an implied exception for Rule 16 material. So that's the contract we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, why
can't... Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry. We actually say that the agreement with the government, that's one argument, that it's unenforceable. And we also say that, yes.
There's an implied exception to the agreement.
Not implied. That was really the understanding of the parties at the time.
Whatever. There's an exception for Rule 16 material, which, of course, depends on it being material. Why don't they have standing under their contract, under their agreement with you, to contest the materiality determination? See, you're looking at this as if 16, which is sort of strange, because you agree that under 16 they have standing to talk about 16D. But you say under 16 they're precluded from arguing on the materiality question. And I'm trying to think, well, wait a minute. Their position here, cause of action is wrong. Their position here is based on the contention that the government breached its agreement with it, right?
Yes.
Okay. One part of that agreement, according to the government, is there's an implied term relating to materiality under Section 16. So why don't they have standing under their agreement to contest that? I'm trying to figure out where your standing argument comes from, other than the fact you don't want anybody screwing up your criminal proceedings. But I don't know where the law comes that allows you to argue there's no standing.
Your Honor, in terms of the agreement that we entered into Williams itself, we would say that the agreement itself, as understood by us, was that we could make any use of the documents in the criminal proceedings. We could have used it in our case in chief. We could have used that. We could disclose it under Rule 16 or Brady.
You could have a U.S. attorney announce it in a press conference. Is that correct?
We would have had to use it in the criminal proceedings.
I don't want to use any far-fetched examples.
And if we were standing before this court in an affirmative way, trying to make
that a U.S. attorney could have announced it in a press conference?
If he puts it in an indictment.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. If that was part of the criminal proceedings. The agreements, as far as we can tell, and there's not a lot of evidence about what the agreements were, says there was a waiver to the United States, and there was a waiver towards in favor of the United States' investigation. It did not say that the government was precluded from disclosing the documents to any other party. We think a reasonable interpretation, and the interpretation we actually have.
So you don't even have to rely on 16. You think you have a right to disclose it to anybody?
As part of the investigation, as part of the criminal proceedings, yes. But we think this case is easier because it's a more confined disclosure within Rule 16 or Brady.
Well, now you're saying that Williams doesn't have a right to contest your interpretation of the agreement, that you could use it in any way you wished relating to a criminal proceeding, including a press conference.
We're saying that Williams had the burden here, and they didn't meet the burden of proving what the contours of the agreement were.
Isn't the answer to my question yes?
Yes, we would have thought that we could use it like that.
If 16 is really not all that relevant anyway.
If the court agrees with us that Williams hasn't met its burden, that's right. We just think that we could use it for any purpose we wanted, and we think that and we agree that the state of the record is not good and that the government made missteps.
When the government filed its response to Thompson's motion to compel, the government took the position in writing that it had agreed to receive and hold the documents in confidence on terms that negate waiver. Now, that's the government's position in the district court. Now, you have a different position in your brief on appeal, but at least the district court was proceeding under the assumption that that was the government's position.
And we agree we were less than clear in the district court.
That's not less than clear,
counsel.
You're
very clear. That's the problem, that you were clear.
Well, yes. Those statements were in the context of us not believing that the material was Rule 16 or Brady. And in that context, we didn't think that we could disclose those documents. Like, we didn't think we could just disclose them to the California adversaries as part of the agreement. But once the Rule 16 or Brady determinations were made, we always believed that we could use these in our case in chief and that we could use them as we needed for
the
criminal
proceedings. Suppose you wanted to use one of the California plaintiffs as a witness in this case.
If we needed to disclose it as part of this case, that would be fine.
To that California
because it would have been part of the criminal proceedings, yes.
And furthermore, Williams would have no standing to challenge that.
That's right in terms of the agreement. I mean, that's our vision of the agreement.
He loses under the agreement, not loses. No standing.
That's right, Your Honor.
Well, which is it? Would he have standing or not?
Loses under the agreement.
So therefore, we shouldn't reach standing because we decide the merits first and he loses.
Yes, this case should follow the procedure followed in Berganzi in the Ninth Circuit, where the court simply found that the disclosures were covered under the agreement, even though the United States in the district court took a similar position as it did here and said that there was a protection of waiver. But on appeal, we took the position that the agreement covered the disclosure, and the Ninth Circuit upheld it, and that's what we would urge this court to do.
Make counsel because we've taken up a lot of your time.
Yeah,
thank you very much. All right, counsel for Appellee Thompson.
You are the one party that doesn't seem to agree to that a protective order is appropriate.
May it please the court. That it is correct to say that. Defendant Thompson, and I'm Philip Nglima, counsel for Defendant Appellee Thompson, that he does not believe a protective order is merited, that a protective order is legally obligated, but we are agreeable to a protective order of limited extent if the case returns to the district court with such requirements. The only proper extent would be to say that Thompson would not publish the materials outside the context of his criminal case. There should be no requirement that he seek or obtain prior approval of the district court for the use of those materials.
Why?
Because he has been granted the use of them by a finding of the district court that they're properly compelled to discover.
I still don't understand. Why do you care? Do you want to turn them over to the plaintiffs in the California case?
No, Your Honor. But that's consistent with what I just said. I do not want to give them to the plaintiffs in any other matter. I want to have free use of them in this case, in the courthouse.
Why? But the protective order, I gathered, would allow you free use in this case. Is that correct?
Yes, and I'm saying that we would agree to the free use of the materials in the criminal case against Scott Thompson in the district court. We would agree, as long as we did not have to seek prior approval of the court to use them for impeachment, to introduce them into evidence, they'd be subject to the same evidentiary and procedural.
Why is it that you're concerned about that?
Because this should not be a way of getting of affording the government a screen on the defense strategy. And
why would it be the government? The government wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Well,
it would be between you and Williams and the court.
Well, Williams should have no part in a pending criminal case in the U.S. District
Except
Court.
Except that it's material.
If it becomes a protective order, they certainly have a right to be there to make sure their protective order is protected.
No, we very much disagree, Your Honor. The only protective order to which we would agree would be one which would say that they would be aggrieved if we published them outside of this case. They have no right to participate in the prosecution of an individual with constitutional rights and statutory discovery rights.
Suppose you wanted to have an expert witness examine some documents and offer evidence in your defense. What would be the problem with getting the prior approval of the district court for that kind of release?
Your Honor, there are layers.
That's distinct from using it for impeachment or something like that.
There are layers of problem. The expert, if he is to be used by us, and normally an expert is engaged as a consultant or an expert, and until his evidence is admitted in the case after complying with Rule 16 disclosure requirements, until that point, it need not be disclosed to anyone else. He would be subject to the protective order just as would we.
That's all I meant. So the California plaintiffs couldn't get through that expert.
Correct. I agree, Your Honor.
All right.
But would you be able to put on evidence one way or another?
If the court were to deem it admissible under the rules of evidence and under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, yes, we would.
Well, that's giving the judge the discretion, isn't it?
That's what all discovery and trial rules.
So then why are you objecting to the scope of the protective order that the government is offering?
I'm not sure I know the scope that the government has proposed. My understanding was simply that it would not permit us to publish or share these outside of our case to third parties, and we're completely agreeable to that. But if one of the plaintiffs in the California case sits in the back of the courtroom during our trial,
which is just what I'm anticipating.
Exactly.
That is not our problem.
And in fact, if I were you, I'd be trying to figure out ways in which I could make sure that got in, or threatened to get in. Else, you would argue that it'd be unconstitutional to convict your client. So that would be a device I'd be trying to hold on to if I were you.
Your Honor,
this is becoming a nightmare.
Unlike Williams, Thompson bears no ill will to Williams. Thompson.
No, I understand. I understand what you're doing.
Thompson has a right to try his case. He has a right to his discovery. It has been ordered by the district court. The Rule 16 materiality determination of the district court is not properly before this court on appeal.
Where is that materiality determination?
I agree with the United States with regard to that, Your Honor. The district court stated.
What I'm getting at is there were lots of documents that were turned over. I mean, some, they have nothing to do with this case of any relevance whatsoever, and potentially could be harmful, say, on a competitive basis. And I can't understand why it should just be a blanket grant without the district court even looking at the documents, where there's been an objection on the grounds of a privilege.
Well, there was an objection on privilege, and there is no doubt that the district court found that that was not a proper objection. The district court stated unequivocally on July 8th that he found this was a voluntary production. So that is completely inconsistent with the notions of privilege that Williams is now claiming is some residual protection for them. So Williams has no privilege in the materials it provided.
The district judge has found that, right? That's subject to review here.
We disagree, Your Honor.
It's not subject to review here?
We believe that the narrow exceptions after indictment in a criminal case for third-party intervention and appeal aren't met in this instance.
Oh, this is your argument about appealability.
This is our jurisdictional argument.
If you lose your jurisdictional argument.
If we lose that argument, Your Honor, then we believe that the fullest extent of this court's review would be on the waiver issue, would be on either the coercion as a basis for not finding waiver or work product waiver somehow surviving the coercion analysis.
Can I give you a hypothetical question?
Yes.
Suppose you assume there is no material, I don't want to repeat myself, there's none of the documents satisfy materiality under 16. Are you hurt then if they're not disclosed?
If I understand the question, if we assume that the district court erred?
No, assume, yeah, so you can assume the district court. I don't want you to get into the appealability question. Let's assume, starting from scratch, there is none of this material that is, none of this material that's material. I can't avoid the duplication. Is there any injury to your client?
Your Honor, if we were without doubt that the material ordered below was not within the scope of any discovery rule.
Well, materiality would do it, wouldn't it?
It would, or Brady would. They're two different.
If you assume arguendo that none of the documents et al. Are material, then you would not be injured by an order holding them in confidence.
Your Honor, to give that ground is the equivalent of saying a different case than ours, because
yes,
Scott
that's
Thompson.
What hypotheticals are.
But Your Honor,
that's what our hypotheticals.
Well, then
we would
have no problem. In fact, Mr. Thompson probably wouldn't be indicted because the district
Wait
courts.
Wait a minute, that doesn't follow, does it? That doesn't follow. We don't know that the material Williams handed over to the government, which you're seeking discovery of, was crucial in the indictment.
Your Honor, if I may, I disagree. The district court's order said that the government should produce to us that material that resulted ultimately in the indictment of the defendant, Scott Thompson, and the government promptly began producing to us materials given to it by Williams under its cooperation agreement. That certified to us that this was used in our indictment. So there is no question that the government perceived it that way, and they have represented both in pleadings and in open court, that there are more materials to which we're entitled, including, and we keep hearing attorney notes from Williams. These are not attorney notes. These are attorneys' interviews of witnesses. These are witness statement notes, which are just the purest type of material information we could require under Rule 16. Now, the district court did a discussion with us in two hearings about whether or not Jenks comes in at a certain point, Rule 16 at a certain point. In the end, the judge said, you know what? This was what the government and Williams thought mattered most to defining the cooperation obligation that Williams voluntarily chose to undertake.
If he didn't review it.
He knew that because Williams' counsel proffered to him that there were three categories of information and did not dispute our representations that they included attorney notes of the statements by three cooperators who are lined up to be the key witnesses against Scott Thompson at trial below. So we know that information would inform our preparation of our defense. It does not have to be Brady exculpatory to be material under Rule 16.
I understand. That's why I used materiality, because that's the broadest concept, right?
Agreed.
So you would agree if for some reason it wasn't material, you wouldn't have any injury?
In that world, we wouldn't, Your Honor.
You would not.
But
so
Williams
everything
also.
Everything depends, in your view, as to whether the documents are material.
That is true, and the district court is entitled to deference from this court. This court is not to perform a de novo review of such determinations, and in this instance, it isn't to perform a review at all. There is no case in this circuit saying that a third party comes in and brings before this court a materiality determination. And if that were the law, we would have companies lined up every time they produce under a grand jury subpoena, coming in and saying, oh, but we didn't really think you'd use that at trial. That's business proprietary, or that's some of our attorney opinion may have seeped into that. They would find multiple reasons to come before this court on appeal of district court discovery orders in cases in which they are not even a party, where the government could not bring that appeal.
Well, let me ask you, I understand the floodgates argument, but what about the Third Circuit's reasoning where it looked at Douglas and also the Seventh Circuit case?
We disagree, Your Honor. We say in our brief that we believe RMI is not correctly decided. It is not consistent with this circuit's opinions on related issues. And it, frankly,
wait,
it ranges.
Wait. What opinions is it inconsistent with in this circuit? We haven't spoken on this issue.
Well, to the extent that RMI is finding jurisdiction on a quasi-Perlman basis, we think it goes beyond the very limited instances in this circuit where there's been any such finding. There is not an instance in this circuit where a third party intervened post-indictment to stop discovery proceedings in the district court for a criminal defendant. And RMI is basically parsing together different principles and expanding its jurisdiction in a way that we think is improper. And we strongly urge this court not to follow that lead because we think that it would open the floodgates, as we've argued. Your Honor, in the district court, Judge Leon made clear what the basis was for his ruling. He said that all of the material pursuant to Williams' cooperation, by definition that means he found that it was the voluntary agreement, cooperation with the federal investigations that resulted in the indictment of Thompson must be produced. He then stated in a subsequent hearing where that exact ruling was challenged.
Give me that phrase again, exactly.
And where can we find it?
It's at Joint Appendix 159. This is the order itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, I thought that's where you were.
It is. It's a model of brevity and clarity in our view, Your Honor. It states, all materials disclosed to the government by Williams pursuant to Williams' cooperation. Go on.
It's interesting. It's cooperation with the federal investigations that resulted in the indictment. There's no effort in that sentence to link the materials to the indictment. They're linked only to the investigations, right? They're two completely separate elements there, as the sentence makes clear.
I'm not sure that I see a distinction, though, Your Honor.
There is a big distinction. If the documents brought about the indictment, then it seems to me that was your initial reading. If the documents simply are part of a room full of stuff that was disclosed in the investigations, and then step two, completely, there's an indictment arising out of completely different documents, the linkage is broken.
Well, the court, Your Honor, may have found first that this would put the burden on the United States to determine what documents were provided.
It's not much of a burden because it's all that has to happen is that the documents go to the government and the investigation produces an indictment, right?
Your Honor.
That's all.
But the
maybe
agents,
no connection at all between the documents and the indictment.
Those documents were used by the agents who did the field work. They were available to the agents in questioning and the prosecutors in questioning witnesses.
How do we know all that?
Yeah, how do we know that?
Well, this is all within the custody of the United States as it performs its investigation. This is the standard procedure.
Yeah, now you're hypothesizing that it was used in some fashion that we do not know.
Well, see, I disagree with the premise, Your Honor, that the district court had to find that a document was marched into the grand jury and waived before the grand jury before it voted.
It's clearly the district judge had to find materiality, right?
He did, Your Honor.
He had to find that.
I agree. He did have to find it.
And what was it based on?
It was based upon his
finding.
What
does he say? Why is it material?
There are two levels to it, Your Honor. And I believe, frankly, that the district court found that once there had been clear demonstration of waiver, that Williams had already explained why these three classes of material were particularly probative.
Counsel, that's not responding to my question.
Why was it material, Your Honor?
How does the judge explain why this document are material?
He doesn't explain, Your Honor.
Material.
He doesn't explain, but he relies upon our briefs and our argument below, where we maintained, first, that there are statements by witnesses who will be key cooperators. Second, that there are data analyses which go directly to an element of the offense. And if you look at the deferred prosecution agreement, Williams does not concede influence or impact or potential to impact market prices. And so their data analyses were actually, it is clear from the record, prepared in order to argue against a finding of liability on their part. And therefore, the district court could reasonably think, well, if they've argued it was not impactful, it didn't meet an element, how could that not be material to Mr. Thompson? The third category is the presentations they made to DOJ, and those, frankly, are of the least interest to us, but they are the most gratuitous. No subpoena called for those presentations. No requirement of cooperation said, come in and give us a PowerPoint and give all of your thought processes as you do so. They asked for investigative files. They didn't ask for attorney analysis. That analysis was gratuitously given, and it frankly was not much damage for the court to say, you know, you've opened the floodgates yourselves in your cooperation. rather than do the searching inquiry of each document, I'm going to give it to the defendant, and then we'll make our judgments at trial about what comes in. And that's essentially what Judge Leon did. And this court must defer to the district court if we're going to have orderly administration of criminal trials, or every discovery decision will be coming up here. Finally, Your Honor, I want to note that we take hot contest with this repeated assertion by Williams that on the issue of waiver, there is undisputed and uncontradicted evidence below. It's well argued in our briefs and in our hearings below, but we disputed many of the assertions that they made, which overblow the supposed agreement with the United States. No agreement could extend beyond.
I think we've got that in your brief, counsel.
Very well. I'll submit on that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for Williams Corporation.
Will the government get a chance to come back now? I would like to ask the government some questions. Yeah.
Why don't we have the government, Mrs. Rao, come back for a moment?
Let's assume, arguendo, ma'am, that materiality is the judge's finding of materiality is before us. Okay. What is the government's position with respect to the question of whether or not the documents are material?
I think the trial prosecutors who know these documents much better than I, Your Honor, would say that we still believe in our own view that they're not material, but we don't think that the district court's order was frivolous. That a finding materiality would
be
frivolous.
You're not familiar enough with the documents to be able to answer the question of whether...
I'm really not familiar with them at all, Your Honor. I do have them in my office, but I don't know much about the case and the facts.
Thank you.
All right, counsel for the Williams Corporation.
Your Honors, let me start with going back to the scope of the order. We don't know what the district court did. We've gravitated toward materiality, but if we are impliedly assuming that the district court picked bases, we could just may as well choose Brady in addition to Rule 16. And I would submit, even if there had been a finding, a factual finding on Brady, under Rule 52C, you'd have to reverse on that. So we simply don't know what the district court did, and we are speculating. In terms of materiality, I think materiality under this court's...
That if the district court had found this was Brady material, we would have to reverse? Is that what you said?
Correct, Your Honor, because it is highly improbable, if not inconceivable, that in the face of the Justice Department representations, the nature of these materials, like PowerPoints, that this could be Brady. And all that I am...
Well, the district court, if he made a finding, disagreed with the government, and he found that was Brady.
I think, you counsel, you
yeah.
misstated the way you wanted to put it.
I just want to be clear what your argument is.
You confused us. I think what you meant was that if there had been a finding that there was Brady without any explanation or that would it be appropriate for us to rely on, it would have been reversible. Is that your point?
Correct, Your Honor. And thank you for clarifying. And my main point is simply that we don't know what the district court did. Materiality under Rule 16 has bite under United States versus Armstrong. The test is, a defendant is only able to get information. Rule 16B, material information, is material that would help the defendant significantly alter the quantum of proof in the criminal trial.
Counsel, what do you say about the standing argument?
On the standing issue, I think the Justice Department concedes, and we agree, there's certainly constitutional standing. I think they're standing by virtue of the breach of our agreement, and also standing by virtue of the breach of our privileges. And I would address Judge Williams' point in terms of the materiality balancing test. If we suppose, and this is really what RMI and the Third Circuit is getting to, suppose that the Justice Department agreed that we have an agreement not to produce this material unless it's Rule 16. If in the district court the Justice Department had said, well, we're going to have an open file policy, we think it's all material, we'd have no rights under the very agreement that they say that they had with us. And that is, in effect, what the government did in the RMI case. The government said, we're going to have an open...
RMI is a little different, all right? I mean, an RMI had posited to the district court specific harm all right, competitive disadvantage, and it had asked the district court for a very specific protective order, and the district court hadn't considered the merits of it, so the Third Circuit sent it back. Here, as I understand it, the government is saying, we agree we had an agreement, and you waived all of your privileges with respect to our investigation of the Williams Company. And our investigation led to the indictment of a number of people, including your client, and so we can use that consistent with our agreement with you.
Well, two points there to respond, Your Honor. One is, I think the Justice Department is trying very hard to suggest to you that there's an interpretation of an agreement which provides you, in effect, with an easy out, which is that, they could use...
I read the letter that was written on behalf of your client to the government at page 47 of the joint appendix. I mean, that's your own language, counsel.
It is, Your Honor. It is. But our view and the Justice Department's view was that the documents could only be used for purposes of the investigation. And the Justice Department took the position in the district court that the action against Thompson was a prohibited use under that agreement. And so I understand that they are taking a somewhat different position of the agreement, but that is those are the terms that we entered into with the Justice Department. I think it would be unfair and not supported by the record to recast on appeal what was indisputably the terms of the deal we had with the Justice Department. And in terms of the standing issues, again, Your Honor, I think we have it for the reasons I mentioned. And so to sum up, I think we should have the benefit of the protection of this court's guidance from In Re Subpoenas Ducis Tecum that confidentiality agreements are protective. We should also have the benefit of the Justice Department's word. We should also have the benefit of a Rule 16 materiality determination that was not made.
Of course, in the district court, the government distinguished In Re Subpoena Ducis Tecum in your favor. Now on appeal, they're not construing it in your favor and saying you lose under Subpoena Ducis Tecum.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think what the Justice Department is saying is you don't need to determine whether those agreements operate to prevent the disclosure to third parties because the agreement itself within its four corners prevents that, and that's just not supported by the record. And so I think a faithful application of what the agreement was in light of In Re Subpoena Ducis Tecum means that the district court's order should be reversed.
No, but I'm talking about the three factors we identified in Subpoena Ducis Tecum that you would lose under that analysis. All right, because first of all, I mean, you want this, you have a personal interest here, you want to make selective disclosure, then the agreement, even the terms of your own letter says, you know, to the extent the government able to keep these confidential. We want their support, which is a little different than an ironclad agreement. And then the whole policy concern about the defendant's right to a fair trial, where there is material evidence at stake, and balancing that interest against your client's interest, where they turned over this information in pursuit of, benefit to themselves. Assuming for the moment that you failed to show you were coerced into turning those documents over.
Your Honor, I would disagree that we lose under In Re Subpoena Ducis Tecum. There wasn't an agreement in place that was a significant factor in the court's decision.
That's your key. It's that second factor.
Yeah, I think
you had an agreement, and that's the whole of your argument under Subpoena Ducis Tecum.
That's precisely right.
You had an agreement, but the defendant would be prejudiced.
Well, Your Honor, I think in that case, it would be no different. The agreement simply allows us to put our work product material, which the government otherwise would not get, on the same footing as the government's work product material and the criminal defendant's work product material. And so, the criminal justice system tolerates every day a circumstance where that type of material is not produced. And so if the agreement accomplishes what we in the Justice Department say it accomplished, that is a harm that the system tolerates. So
I have a question as to the meaning of the district court's order. I'm looking at page 159. I think the language is identical at 160. There are two clauses. Ordered that the defendant's motion is granted, and further ordered is this language that I talked at length with government counsel about, the sort of two-step thing where anything in the investigation, where the investigation produced the indictment. Is the defendant's motion, and what's the relationship between those two clauses?
Our reading of the district court's order, and I think the way the Justice Department has behaved in response to the order, is that the order says produce all of the documents that were provided by Williams to DOJ in connection with the investigations. It does not say produce only those documents that resulted in the indictment of Mr. Thompson. I think that is the fairest and most obvious way to read it.
But I guess the question is, obviously we have to look at the defendant's motion, but why is there that clause on the defendant's motion is granted?
Defendant Thompson's motion was produced that Williams, anything Williams produced to the Justice Department was waived and therefore should be turned over.
So it's a motion that doesn't even use the word materiality.
I don't want to represent that, Your Honor, without being able to look at it again. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.